Welcome to episode 13 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, now a partner in Steptoe's New York office. Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, and is now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. Our guest interview today, we're very lucky to have Michael Allen, who's the founder and managing director of Beacon Global Strategies, was former majority staff director at the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Prior to that, had substantive and legislative jobs in the Bush administration. And I am Stuart Baker, formerly with NSA and DHS, and holding the record for returning to Steptoe and Johnson the most number of times. So let's get started with our traditional opening segment, at least for the last several months, which is This Week in NSA. A couple of big developments in the last week. The House Intelligence Committee has come up with a proposal to replace NSA's 215 metadata program with systems in which the data is going to remain with the phone companies. At the same time, and pretty clearly in competition with the House Intelligence Committee, the Obama administration has been working on an approach that would do the same thing. Essentially, this indicates that the process that was supposed to take up March and produce a recommendation did, and the recommendation was that the president abandon the current program and instead move to a program in which the data is left with the phone companies, and the phone companies are not subjected to a data retention requirement beyond those that already apply under FCC rules. That's a pretty substantial change, and the decision by the House Intelligence Committee to embrace it, it seems to me, is a big step back from their past stalwart defense of the program as it was originally designed. I've written a blog post on this right after the administration leaked the fact that they were coming up with their own legislation just in time to compete with the House Intelligence Committee's unveiling of its bill. What I said at the time, and I may ask the others to join in, is this really seemed like a missed opportunity for the president and the administration. They had managed to persuade the Intelligence Committees to back down off of defending the program, and they could have worked with them to come up with a proposal that would have had bipartisan support in both houses. And instead, they seem to have said, oh, no, we just don't like that House bill. That House bill doesn't call for the courts to get involved in reviewing every identifier that goes into the process, and therefore we're just rejecting the House proposal out of hand. We're going to write our own. And that didn't seem to me that that difference was big enough to really justify walking away from an opportunity to talk to the Intelligence Committee at this stage. What was your sense, Mike?
Well, you know, this reminded me a lot of our negotiations on the House Intelligence Committee with the White House on cybersecurity. I say negotiations. I use that as a very broad and liberal term because they weren't really negotiations. I think that they believe that the president needs to be separate and apart from those who are either advancing legislation on cybersecurity that is not exactly what they're doing, and the same goes for NSA. I think that you're exactly right. The administration saw that Rogers and Ruppersberger were moving towards a Tuesday 11 a.m. rollout of NSA, and they quickly called up the New York Times and put out their version of what could happen because they didn't want to be seen as leading from behind again.
So that is pretty much what happened with the information sharing program. The president had written a draft bill, or at least his administration had produced a draft bill. And then when the Intelligence Committee actually got a bipartisan majority, I think both parties, to pass it, the president said, oh, well, but it lacks a bunch of clauses that my bill also lacked, and so far, therefore, I'm going to issue a kind of veto threat. That was bizarre. So this is a... You think this is not the NSC process run amok, but this is actual positioning by the legislative and public affairs guys to say we have to be closer to the privacy folks than the Intelligence Committee?
I think it's a little of both, but I think it's mostly that they believe that the president is speaking to a different sector than the people in Washington respond to, and we call them here, you know, the privacy and civil liberties folks. I think they believe that they are in a stronger position vis-a-vis the president's priorities to be sort of apart from the people who are vigorously defending the National Security Agency. After all, the president's speech, you know, we can talk a little bit about the speech from late January, but that was 7-8 months after the original Snowden thing. There had to have been some strategic positioning that would explain the distance from the actual event to when they actually spoke about it.
So if this is in part about the theater and the positioning, then it makes sense for the House just to keep rolling forward as fast as it can and as aggressively as it can with its bill and make the negotiations sort of as high stakes as possible and as high visibility as possible so that the president can say, I held out for my thing, which is to have the FISA court approve these identifiers before they go into the process, which is certainly something you could probably add to the House bill if you wanted to.
No, I think so. I mean, I think the task for Chairman Rogers and Mr. Rippersberger now is to see if they can get 218 votes behind what they have put together. They need to show that they have some strength in order to convince the leadership to put this legislation on the floor. I think it's an uphill battle because of the Edward Snowden issues that have cropped up across the Republican and Democratic conferences, but it's something that they felt like they needed to go ahead and put out there because it wasn't going to get any better.
Yeah. Well, it will be very interesting. Actually, that is a good question, whether there's 218 votes. The president has sort of given everybody permission to vote against this, and a good half of the Republican caucus is sort of half against it as well. So it's going to be tricky to get 218 for this particular proposal. But maybe there'll be a negotiation with somebody. Maybe the president will send somebody to say, okay, I can live with this bill.
Yeah, I wouldn't look for that. I think that I think what the president is going to do is what he did again on cyber. And you know, if you look back on some of these votes, the two cyber information sharing bills, the defeat of the Amash amendment that would have defunded Patriot Act 215, and then likely what you'll see if we ever have another FISA vote is sort of a new coalition of
left-right
people who can, you know, let's call them sort of the Republicans that maybe weren't necessarily elected
right
in the last couple of elections, and then a lot of the Democrats who were comfortable voting with Dutch Rupersberger, and then you can get a majority.
I still have thought that it's a very hard vote to say, I just want this program dead, you know, with nothing to replace it, which is what we get on June 1, 2015. So it's always been my assumption that if there's a plausible reform proposal sitting in front of Congress, that they'd rather have that than just take the responsibility for killing the program.
That's right. Let's see how things shake out as the year goes on.
Well, another thing that's going to shake out is the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee has announced that he's not coming back. He's not going to run for re-election. As he said, he'd had a career before he went to Congress. He was an FBI agent, and he expects to have a career after Congress. And the rumor is he wants to start a talk show dealing with national security issues, you know, directly competing with the Stepto Cyber Law podcast, evidently moved by our enormous success. You worked with him, but what do you think he's going to be, his contributions are going to be viewed in retrospect?
I think he is going to be seen, first of all, I think it's a loss for the Congress and for the country. His legacy, I think, will end up being that he reestablished the House Intelligence Committee as a force. The way he did that was insisting that the House get back to the business of passing an annual authorization bill. A lot of lawyers in town know if they just pull up the authorization bill online, it looks like a very short document that just deals with the CIA retirement account. But the engine of congressional oversight is a classified annex that accompanies the House Intelligence Authorization Bill. And that discusses dollars, positions, and policy. And the community always has to listen to the Congress, but if the Congress is shooting with real bullets, if they know that they're passing a bill every year and that they can affect their will on the agencies, they're more likely to listen and they're more likely to subject themselves to congressional oversight. So I think that's what people are going to look back as Mike Rogers having figured out a way after a drought from 2004 to 2011 to get back into the annual authorization process.
Well, he also really, at least as I saw it, delivered on the idea of a genuinely bipartisan staff for the Intelligence Committee, because the House and the Senate had gotten away from that for a while. But he and Dutch Ruppersberger obviously have a great relationship, and they've produced a lot of unanimity on both sides of the aisle.
That's exactly right. He was able to strike up a relationship with Dutch Ruppersberger of one of cooperation. I mean, Chairman Rogers is a strong conservative and advanced what he believed frequently, especially in the media and much to the chagrin of the White House most of the time, but was able to do it in a way that was constructive so that Senator Feinstein in the Senate, along with Saxby Chambliss and Dutch Ruppersberger, his counterpart in the House, they all felt like they could work together on the things that would improve oversight. And so I think that's going to be a real legacy for the chairman.
Any predictions about who would replace him, assuming the Republicans stay in power?
I don't know yet. I mean, I've seen a few names pop up recently, but it's really too soon to tell.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting, and you're right. He has been a very good chairman, and we'll miss him. On to the remainder of the NSA news is pretty bullet-pointed. The FISA court is also getting a new chief judge, Thomas Hogan, who's been chief judge in the D.C. Court of D.C. Federal Court. China has promised to bolster its cybersecurity and has formally protested to the United States about news that Huawei had been hacked by NSA. I'm really hoping that the administration has enough of a sense of humor to say, oh, yes, we're victims of hacking, too. Can you tell us exactly what you know about this hacking? Maybe we can help you. I'm not sure that's going to happen, but it would only be fair. Let's move on to this week in Target, because there's been yet another surprising development in this high-stakes case. The banks are not just suing Target. They're suing the Target's security assessor. Jason, is this a sign of strength or an admission that Target isn't such a great target for the lawsuit?
Actually, I think it's something different. I think it's a sign of opportunism and aggressiveness on the part of the and creativity on the part of the banks and their lawyers.
Well, those are words that are not often mixed together.
Well, in federal court in Chicago, there are two banks that claim to have suffered losses from the Target breach, and they've sued Target, which is not surprising. But they've also sued TrustWave, which is the company that validated Target's compliance with the payment card industry standards, and it's a putative class action alleging negligence and all kinds of related claims. And the damages they're seeking are the losses from canceling and reissuing the cards, credit and debit cards that were compromised in the breach. For those that don't know, the PCI data security standard is a set of standards that companies that do business with the payment card industry agree to comply with, and they have to undergo annual security audits and quarterly checks for vulnerabilities, and if they're not compliant, they face big fines. And in the PCI world, TrustWave is what's known as a qualified security assessor. They do security assessments of companies that are subject to the PCI rules, but they also, in addition to that work, they also provide security services to companies to boost their level of security, and they provide ongoing security monitoring services. In the past, breach victims have been sued and been hacked despite being certified as PCI compliant, and the PCI Security Standards Council suggested that if you were breached, by definition, you couldn't have been compliant, which is sort of a convenient position to take. But according to the complaint, TrustWave was not just the QSA here, but they were providing security monitoring services 24/7 to Target. So some of the negligence that's alleged here relates not to the QSA services, but to the security monitoring services. The complaint says that TrustWave failed to identify vulnerabilities in the network that led to the breach, including 2 months before the breach doing a scan and saying that there were no vulnerabilities present when, in fact, there were, or at least signs of trouble, and saying that they missed the intrusion for 3 weeks despite monitoring the network 24 hours a day. So I think that you'll see more suits like this for breaches that are less notorious than Target, and I think the QSAs will argue that in doing their audits, they have to depend on the information provided by the clients, much like financial auditors do for public companies. But to the extent that these companies also provide security monitoring services, I think you're going to – that's a much harder argument to make.
This is the problem that I think they face is it's very attractive because just doing the audits can't be a great revenue producer to branch out into providing additional services because you're right there. You can sell the services. But as soon as you do that, you're really taking on two roles that are not completely consistent.
That's right. And, you know, look, as one of the consequences of the litany of breaches over the last few years is that network security companies have – it's been a growth period for them, and I think they're also going to be on the business end of some of this litigation going forward.
I'm also puzzled by the notion that by definition you haven't lived up to the PCI if you've had a breach because PCI, if it means anything, probably writes down a set of procedures you're supposed to follow, and those procedures are bound to fall out of date over time, unless the theory is you got to follow the procedures and take into account the most sophisticated attacks that have been seen up to that point and protect against them.
Well, the problem is the most sophisticated attack you've seen up to that point is not the most sophisticated attack you've seen this week.
Yes.
And you know, it's a dangerous extension of the thinking that we've talked about on our podcast a number of times, this notion, this sort of blame the victim mentality, that there appears to be a notion that you're negligent until proven reasonable. And
yeah,
if you've been breached, you're by definition negligent. Although speaking of that, there was another Target-related development this week. The FTC, the primary purveyor of the blame the victim mentality, is continuing to use the breaches as an opportunity to expand its own turf. The FTC chair was testified in the Senate Commerce Committee last week on data breach notification and data security legislation. And not surprisingly, she defended the FTC against criticism that it holds companies accountable for failing to adopt reasonable security measures without actually explaining what reasonable is. She proposed that the FTC have rulemaking authority on cybersecurity standards and also proposed bringing nonprofits like universities under the jurisdiction of the FTC. This is probably not a coincidence that the University of Maryland got breached a few weeks ago. And nonprofits like universities are not under FTC jurisdiction now, and she's making a play to see if they can get that turf expanded as well.
Oh, that's interesting. Actually, I can't imagine two institutions that deserve each other more. So I wouldn't break my heart to see that happen. Speaking of institutions that are struggling these days with their public image, Microsoft has gone through a complete somersault, as far as I understand. First, they opened a subscriber's Hotmail account or Outlook account to see which employee was leaking data to them. And then they said, yeah, we did that because we can do it legally. And then they said, we're going to only do it if a retired federal judge tells us it's okay. And now they're saying they're not going to do it at all. Michael, can you elaborate on what's actually going on there?
Yeah, well, Microsoft brought a civil case against a former employee, Alex Kidcalo, who it found was leaking proprietary Microsoft information to a French blogger. And the way they found out about this was not intercepting and searching that former employee's email, but searching the blogger's email because he had a Hotmail account. I would surmise from that the former employee was not using his own Microsoft account when he was leaking the data, which I guess is one of the few smart things he did. But it came out during the civil suit that the way Microsoft gathered this evidence was by getting the blogger's email, which would appear to be authorized by Microsoft's general terms of service, which forbid subscribers from using Hotmail or Outlook for the purpose of stealing or doing something inappropriate with proprietary or intellectual property. And, you know, I think Google and others have similar terms of service. And you could certainly make an argument that the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, both the Wiretap Act part of that and the Stored Communications Act part, also authorize an Internet provider, a communications provider, to search emails when it's necessary to protect their own property and interest. But Microsoft didn't really, you know, as you said, their first reaction was, hey, this is legal. But I think there was such an uproar in the privacy community, or at least the fear that there would be an uproar that would spread outside of cyber libertarians, that Microsoft first, as you said, first said, okay, wait a second, we're going to do something that we don't legally have to do, and that is we're going to have a federal judge on our behalf review every instance in which we want to look at a subscriber's email, and if he says it's okay, then we'll do it. Well, that wasn't good enough, so last Friday Microsoft said, no, what we're actually going to do in these cases is just call in law enforcement and then let law enforcement deal with it if a crime has been committed, which means that the only time Microsoft is going to step in is if the conduct reached the threshold of criminal activity, or at least that's the only time it's going to end up meaning anything.
Yeah, and Google ran into a sort of similar problem, although I'm sure they spent some time enjoying the discomfiture of the guys who brought the Scroogled campaign to life. But Michael Arrington, who's sort of a notorious, he does a lot of press work and is a bit of a hothead, claimed that his Gmail account must have been looked at to identify a leaker in some incident several years ago. So he lashed on this story and took a ride on it. The general counsel of Google said, well, we might have the legal authority to do that, but I can't believe we did. And that seems to be where the story is left. But it does seem to me one of the worries that this new attention to the idea that maybe it's inappropriate for large providers of web services to scrutinize their own communications to find people who are attacking them or their subscribers, what that might mean for cybersecurity. Lots and lots of attacks on users of Gmail come from within Gmail. There's somebody who gets a Gmail account and starts sending malware to other Gmail users. And I've always assumed that Google could go in immediately once they identified the Gmail and figure out who was sending that that malware, block them, maybe block their IP address. Now, does this mean they're going to have to go to law enforcement every time they want to do that? Because that's adding days to a process that has to be fast to be effective.
Yeah, that's a good question. Microsoft didn't seem to indicate that this new process is going to be confined to copyright violations. And you can see how the public reaction is going to be different for a case involving copyright infringement, which most of the public doesn't seem to take very seriously, as opposed to searching for hackers or searching for malware, which the public is the victim of, and so I think the public has a different attitude about the propriety of service providers taking action to identify the sources of those things. But it is interesting to see how broadly Microsoft takes this new approach and whether
Google, Yahoo, and others also go down that road.
Yeah, because we'd all be privacy victims if they started letting people send us malware because they were afraid to look inside the malware author's Gmail or Hotmail account.
But you know, I think this also shows that the attitude of the public about privacy has really changed enormously in the last year or two, and I think you can attribute a lot of that to Edward Snowden, whether you like it or not. There is a lot more attention to privacy issues, and you can see the service providers, communications providers, being much more careful and sensitive because they got caught up in all the NSA scandals, and so they're taking steps like this because they're so worried about being hit over the head with yet another privacy cudgel.
Yep, so instead I hope to hit them over the head with a security cudgel at some point, because this is going to end badly. We'll owe it all to the privacy lobbyists who've made such an issue of this. Speaking of things that are likely to end badly, Bitcoin, new news. We now know what the IRS thinks of it. Jason, what's going on?
Well, so we also know Warren Buffett thinks of it. Warren Buffett declared it to be a fad, and no one ever made any money betting against Warren Buffett in NCAA basketball or otherwise. But I think there are more people, including a lot of venture capital firms, that are betting on Bitcoin. But last week, the IRS issued a long-awaited announcement of how it would treat Bitcoin under the tax code, and they announced it would be treated as property rather than currency for tax purposes, which means it's subject to capital gains tax. So if you pay for a product or a service with Bitcoin, you'll have to pay capital gains tax on the increase in value from the date you acquired it to the date you spent it. And it means that Bitcoin exchanges, the companies that provide services for retailers and others who want to exchange Bitcoin for cash and other currencies, will have to provide consumers, their customers, with annual reports of their transactions, much like your brokerage firms.
1099s.
You'll get 1099s from your Bitcoin exchanges, too. And how you view this really depends on whether you have a glass half full or glass half empty perspective on Bitcoin. If your glass is half full, then you'll focus on the fact that it's a move toward greater legitimacy, that it's a lower tax rate than if it was treated as ordinary income.
True. If
you hold it long enough. And the venture cap firms and a lot of the Bitcoin exchanges actually publicly praised the decision and indicated that there was software already being developed to automate this process of calculating your capital gains taxes. But if your glass is half empty, then you'll focus on the fact that this raises the fundamental catch-22 of Bitcoin. The more it's regulated, the more stable it becomes, but the more it may turn off those who were drawn to it in the first place precisely because it was unregulated. It also raises an interesting question of how treating it as the legal equivalent of an investment, like stocks or real property, will impact its use as a currency. Each time you spend Bitcoin now, you are incurring potential capital gains taxes. It's sort of like buying goods and services with stock.
Plus, now you can't say, I'm sorry, you don't know it. Nobody knows anything about this because every time there's a transaction, there's a taxable event, and somebody, probably two somebodies, have to keep track of the event.
That's
the
right.
Guy who buys it from you or gets it from you is likely to have software that records that he got it from you and at what price. He'd have to work pretty hard to make sure he recorded the price but not who he got it from.
Oh, that's right.
And so the idea that you're hiding your assets, hiding your transactions, getting cash that's even better than cash is starting to fray.
Well, every step toward legitimacy and greater regulation is a step away from anonymity and, you know, the sort of Wild West that attracted a lot of people to this in the first place.
All right, but, you know, it still may look good if you're in China and you're worried about preserving your assets and getting them out of the country easily. Speaking of new government regulation, the European Union has ruled that ISPs actually have to block copyright-infringing sites. And I'm not sure I understand how they're going to do that, let alone why the court thinks that's appropriate. But, Michael, did you look at that?
Yeah. It's interesting. They're going farther and farther now in putting requirements on Internet providers to block sites that are infringing copyrights. And in this case, the European Court of Justice said that an Austrian ISP had to block access to a website, kino.to, that allows users to stream or download copyrighted movies. They didn't explain how this can be done technically, didn't really care about the difficulty or the cost of doing so, but they said this is basically just what EU copyright law requires.
Well, that is sort of classic civil law jurisprudence. You know, it doesn't matter whether it works in practice. The only question is whether it works in theory. If it works in theory, then you have to do it.
Well, it's interesting. That aspect I still have PTSD from the debate over PIPA and SOPA, the IP bills from a couple years ago, because I was at DOJ at the time that this was going on, and it was the part of the legislation that would have involved blocking access to sites as opposed to enabling action to be taken against foreign
sites. I think I was firing the incoming on you.
The administration actually switched, did a complete 180, in part in response to public backlash over the notion that the DNS system was going to be messed with and access to sites would actually be blocked. And it's interesting it'll be interesting to see if the public in the EU reacts the same way to this decision as the public in the U.S. did.
And maybe what will happen is it was always possible to block sites badly so that didn't work, but that you could say, well, we blocked it. And it's possible that that's what will happen, although as you move to DNSSEC, that becomes less attractive. And since this is all in a litigation context, you could get sued for flouting the majesty of the European Court of Justice. And indeed, we're starting to see that here in the U.S., you know, the Innocence of Muslims actress who got what I didn't realize was a five-second appearance.
It was 10. It was a very long performance.
Okay, it was very long. And she got an order telling YouTube to take down the videos. YouTube did it, and she's already back in court claiming that Google didn't do it well enough, that they were snarky when they indicated they didn't agree with the decision, but they were going to do it to the best of their ability anyway, and that you could still find Innocence of Muslims complete versions using Google search, which strikes me as kind of a completely different set of a different case than the one she brought, but maybe I didn't follow her original case closely enough. So the idea of blocking continues to appeal to courts. They just can't quite believe that it can't be done perfectly. The other thing that's happening in court that I find fascinating is that every time there's a privacy settlement these days, and there's always a privacy settlement, and money has to change hands, they're simply, you know, sending us all 25 cents, which is kind of what these settlements are often worth, is so impractical that instead they just want to collect a few million dollars and give it to somebody, anybody. And this is how I learned the word CPRE. This is the idea that you can give money to the closest possible person other than the guy who suffered the loss. Because you get to choose who you're giving it to, it almost inevitably sets off some kind of feeding frenzy on the part of people who'd like to get the money. And there's about an $8.5 million settlement that has gone through two or three rounds of feeding frenzy. Jason, did you look at that?
Yeah, so these CPRE settlements are the gift that keeps on giving for class action plaintiffs' lawyers, because they get theirs regardless of
And do they get to bill the time that they spend arguing about whether they should go to Stanford or Berkeley?
That's a good question. Among the litany of class actions Google's had to contend with over the last few years were a pair of suits alleging that Google violated the Stored Communications Act by sharing search terms with third parties without users' consent. And the class is defined as basically everybody who did a search on Google between October 2006 and the day that the motion was filed seeking approval of the class, which, you know, is well over 100 million people. It might be, you know, a significant portion of the population of the earth. And in July, a proposed settlement was offered to the court that wouldn't require Google to actually change the practice that was being challenged. It would just require Google to update its FAQ on its website to make it clear that the practice was taking place. And it wouldn't provide any financial compensation to the victims, because the damage, if there was any, was infinitesimal. But it would require an $8.5 million CPRE fund that would go to the AARP, Harvard, Stanford, Carnegie Mellon, Chicago Kent College of Law, the MacArthur Foundation, and the World Privacy Forum. So privacy groups, many of whom would have liked to have been the recipient of that $8.5 million, went nuts, arguing that the settlement didn't serve the interests of the class. They noted that there was no monetary relief to users, despite the fact that the Stored Communications Act actually has a statutory damages provision of it, like $1,000 a violation, that it didn't require Google to change its actual practices, and that the proposed group of CPRAE recipients didn't serve the interests of the class. And they noted that only one of those organizations, the World Privacy Forum, actually has the protection of privacy as its mission, and while the others are perfectly legitimate organizations, they're not organizations whose fundamental purpose is protecting Internet privacy. And they actually noted in one of the privacy groups noted in its objection to the court that the universities or the other organizations either are frequent recipients of charitable donations from Google or are alma mater of class counsel and defense counsel. And if nothing else, you know, it's a very creative way to deal with those pesky annual giving calls from your university or law school to make them recipients of your class action settlements. I wish I thought of that.
This is the closest thing to a donation you're going to get.
Exactly. And it's just not your money. But presumably you still get credit for it. And the judge rejected those the challenge to the settlement and gave preliminary approval and said it was fair and adequate and reasonable and required each of the recipients to submit detailed proposals for how they were actually going to use the money to serve the interests of the class, and was satisfied that those proposals were acceptable. And there'll be a hearing on final approval in late August. You know, as you noted, this is not the first case by any means with a settlement like this. Google settled the Buzz class action in a similar fashion. Facebook settled the sponsored stories and the Beacon class actions in a similar fashion. And each time, as you noted, there's some challenge to who the recipients are, what the process is for selecting them. This is the first time I've seen someone cite the fact that the recipients were the alma mater of the council. But even when that's not present, there's some challenge, usually by other privacy groups that got out-competed for the money, challenging who was selected to receive it.
So I think we're going to incorporate the Steptoe Cyber Law podcast as a 501c3. Because we're the only people providing truly balanced privacy coverage. Others are too ideologically committed for courts to be approving payments to them. I think that's great. Well, I'd like to turn now to our interview because this is really – you've already gotten a taste of Michael Allen's expertise. But he's also the author of a book, Blinking Red, that is – probably the canonical description of what happened with the passage of the IRTPA, is that the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention
Act?
That's it. The story of the institution, the DNI institution that was created. The DNI and DHS were created out of more or less the same time, not quite. I remember the difficulties that DHS had getting stood up, and the DNI seems to have gone through that and more, right? My most vivid memory is I had to go to a meeting about the future of, GPS satellites, and I was in the building that I was supposed to be in, wandering around, couldn't find the meeting, and ran into one other guy, and he couldn't find the meeting, and we agreed it was supposed to be in this one room, and it wasn't there, and we didn't know where it was, and finally somebody set us straight, took us to where the meeting had been moved to, and as we were going in, I said, since I was from DHS, I said, by the way, where are you from, to this other guy? He said, I'm from the DNI's office. And I realized it was because these were the two institutions that had fairly high-level officials who did not have some GS-12 whose job was to keep track of when the meeting changed and to get the right location on their principal schedule.
Right.
Every other institution had gotten word because they were set up to deal with that eventuality. And, of course, we were just in interrupt mode trying to figure out, you know, what the next meeting was, let alone whether the meeting place had changed. So can you give a feel for the way the DNI's office evolved through the legislative process and then once it was created that would sort of encapsulate the book. It's a terrific read if you're into interagency politics and legislative politics.
You're hearing your story reminds me of the quip that newborn babies are cute and defenseless and new bureaucracies are just defenseless.
Exactly.
The point of writing the book Blinking Red was to write the authoritative, objective history of what was the most tangible outcome, at least for the intelligence community, of the two, not one, but the two intelligence failures that occurred in President Bush's first term. Of course, 9/11, but also Iraq. It's the story of how the 9/11 Commission was able to capture, in a relatively short order, and dictate the congressional and legislative and executive agenda in the fall of 2004 amidst the backdrop of a presidential election and the rest.
It was a brilliant piece of work.
It was a brilliant. The 9/11 Commission report, I think everybody agrees, was a brilliant rendition of the facts of what went wrong on 9/11, where the praise breaks down is with regard to their recommendations to create a DNI, a quarterback, if you will, a super spy who could manage all 16 other intelligence agencies across the community. And the point of the book is to go through the legislative history of this and make a determination, or at least excavate the history of how each provision that we all claimed would make us safer was really sculpted, and whether that indeed has made us safer or not.
It is fascinating that they did do a great job. It was a novelistic rendition of the facts, and combined with a memo of all the things they could agree on a weekend after they'd written the rest of it, as far as I could tell. But then their political follow-through was terrific as well. I did feel sorry for Secretary Rumsfeld, who had more or less nothing to do with this, and suddenly finds himself thrust into this incredibly emotional debate where everybody is judged by how much turf they take out of his hide.
That's right.
And he must have been astonished to find himself in that spot.
Well, Secretary Rumsfeld, as you remember, used to write these snowflakes, which are one-page memos with a few bullet points of what he thinks, or sentences really, of what he thinks someone ought to do. I got to go through his snowflakes from this period, and he had a couple of good ones. One was sort of noting early that a lot of members of Congress have it in their minds that we need to reorganize the intelligence community, and we, the Department of Defense, need to get out in front of that. And then once the 9/11 Commission came forward with a recommendation, he sent a memo, and I talk about this in the book, to President Bush, which was sort of classic Rumsfeld, very biting, almost sarcastic, that was trashing the 9/11 Commission, and he implored the president. He said, you know, Mr. President, members of Congress, the media, and John Kerry can afford to be wrong, and there is no penalty. For matters of such importance, the President of the United States must be right. And he sort of ended the memo with just one word hanging out there, caution. Caution. And so Rumsfeld was upset about any bureaucratic fix that would have transferred authority away from the Department of Defense, be it to the old Director of Central Intelligence or a new Director of National Intelligence, and a lot of the folks in the defense community fought it tooth and nail.
Yeah. Well, and he was fighting two wars. The generals, when they're fighting wars, believe that there is no need, you know, no corporal's need for intelligence should go unserved at the expense of knowing anything about what's happening in the Kremlin when the war is being fought. So there's a legitimate fight there, right? But you can understand why he would be emotional about it. The best line, you've written a very balanced, almost too balanced. There were two or three places where I thought, okay, I think this must be Mike Allen personally seeing this, watching this, but most of the time you couldn't tell what your viewpoint was. But the best line, one I had not heard, was Henry Hyde at the height of the angst between the Senate and the House over whether they're going to pass a bill and what's going to be in it addresses the Republican caucus. He can barely be heard because he's a little ill at the time. And somebody says, what did he say? What did he say? And his interlocutor says, he says the House and the Senate are a lot alike. Each of them has about 100 members that aren't that bright.
Yeah, that was part of what rallied the Republicans to fight against Speaker Hastert and the 9/11 Commission, was that they felt like they had something being crammed down on them by the United States Senate. And that the book is more than a legislative history. It's not the classic Republican versus Democrat. It's Senate versus House. It's bureaucracy versus bureaucracy. So that's why a lot of people have enjoyed reading the book.
No, it's great. If you want to know how legislative affairs is done out of the White House in the modern era, or at least until this administration, which actually isn't interested in doing it, it's a great discussion of that and of the difficulties of doing it when you actually control one of the houses. So
that actually makes it harder.
Yes. Yeah, because everybody knows when you sit down to negotiate with the other party that it's just a question of, you know, each of you have to give something and you're either going to get an agreement or you're not. But when you sit down with your party, every single personality matters, and there's an assumption that is completely false that you want more or less the same thing. It was fascinating to see how Denny Hastert ends up in such a bind trying to make his president a success.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It was a it happens all the time now with the Speaker Boehner, but at the time it was a unique thing to have the conference rise up against the speaker, but it definitely gives you a glimpse of the perils of the trying to manage your conference in the modern age.
So this president has to manage a Senate that he has a 55-45 vote advantage in, and Harry Reid. Have you seen the same tensions and difficulties working themselves out when it's a D on D as opposed to R on R issues?
I think there are inevitably tensions. I mean, if you read the Woodward books and then you see recently on Fast Track Trade Promotion Authority when the president is supposedly for it and Harry Reid announces he's not going to do it, I mean, presidents of their own party do have some trouble occasionally trying to have their way, but it seems like President Obama is having a hard time in the Senate also.
I guess that's right. It's just that the press covered that stuff with the Bush administration with lip-smacking glee.
Oh, of course.
And when it's D on D, they just sort of say, oh, yeah, well, that didn't work.
Republican-on-Republican violence gets a lot more attention.
Yeah. So the other topic I wanted to talk about is the flap between the CIA and the Senate Intelligence Committee, which has completely gone underground in the last 10 days.
Right.
It's quite remarkable and quite grown up of them all. But it really became remarkably bitter, remarkably fast. And I just wondered, you've done oversight, how does oversight get to the point where it's that bitter?
It sounds like, first of all, it was extraordinary. I did not see this coming. I knew that there were a lot of disagreements between the Senate Intelligence Committee's majority and the Central Intelligence Agency about what would be in this enhanced interrogation.
That's right. The Senate is a much more partisan division within the staff, if I remember right.
On this issue in particular, the Republicans withdrew from the investigation a couple of years ago, and it has been going on for 5 years. And so this was extraordinary because you had a deep reservoir of resentment, apparently, that was being built up between the Central Intelligence Agency and the committee. And it really just exploded onto the front pages when Senator Feinstein went down to the Senate. The CIA apparently has a lot of problems with some of the conclusions that the Senate has come to, and the Senate is equally angry that the CIA would try and rebut their report, and so it is a real mess.
So the acting general counsel that was attacked on the Senate floor by Dianne Feinstein is Bob Eatinger, and I guess he's deputy now because we have a new general counsel. Did you work with him?
Yes.
And what do you think? Is he a straight shooter, or is this? Would you have also been concerned about the criminal referral?
Well, I don't know that I have a complete grip on the facts. I mean, let me say that it seemed like both parties went high order very, very quickly.
Yeah.
I thought that maybe some of these things could have been negotiated going forward. Maybe we'll find out the truth that they were and that this was the only way Senator Feinstein felt like they could win the day was to go public with the dispute. But it seemed like a very, very it felt like a tinderbox when something exploded.
I think that's right. You know, my sense on this is in part the Senate Intelligence Committee reacted very badly to the criminal referral, suggesting that maybe they had moved documents or exceeded their authority on the computer system, fashion that violated federal law. I don't know. I'm inured to this. When I was general counsel, we sent over crimes reports, criminal referrals, every week of the year.
Right.
Every time, well, not every time, but practically every time somebody did a polygraph, especially an entry polygraph, you spend most of the time explaining which crimes they are taking off the table before they ask you the question again.
That's right.
They say, let's see. Tell me when you did smoke marijuana. Okay, let's put that aside. If that's 5 years ago, I'll ask you again. Have you smoked marijuana in the last 5 years? You did shoplifting when you were in high school. We'll take that off the list of crimes. But all those crimes they're taking off the list, they're making a note of, and they refer them to the Justice Department see if they want to prosecute you. And, of course, they never do. It's just but that means there's criminal referrals all the time.
Standard procedure.
So, nobody in the agency is surprised anymore if a criminal referral comes up. If they're involved in something controversial and high stakes, there's a decent shot that there'll be a criminal referral, and that doesn't really mean they're going to be prosecuted. And surely the Senate Intelligence Committee sort of knew that cerebrally, but maybe there's a big difference from knowing it intellectually and actually
and seeing it happen to
you.
Them. I think it was just that it happened to them in the course of a long simmering dispute that really, really set them off.
Yeah.
And so it's ugly, but I suspect they're now negotiating it out.
Yeah, they must be. Yeah. And so naturally, if the only response to being said, being told, you think that, if somebody says, I think you, Stuart Baker, committed a crime, my first response is to go find a crime that my interlocutor has also committed and say, well, you're another. And that may be part of this, is that as soon as one person brought the idea of a criminal violation up, then it was easy for the other side to find a criminal violation as well and to start talking about it. But it's appalling.
I hear you on the automaticity of the criminal referral process. We did a lot of investigations into the process when there's a classified piece of information that ends up in the media and how it ends up going to the Justice Department, and we discovered they are filing criminal referrals almost every time they open the newspaper. And so I had a little bit of the same reaction that you did, which is that this is just the normal course of business, but I can also see the Senate's point that it looked like a separation of powers issue.
Yeah. So the fact that this has been a five-year investigation means it really was started under the Bush administration.
That's right.
Yeah, so that would account for starting out with the assumption that there's something evil to be found and that the Democratic majority staff is going to find it. And once you start down that road, you view everything the agency tells you as obstruction at the behest of the current administration, and then when the administration changes and the attitude doesn't, you just assume it's holdovers and they're protecting their own activities under the last administration, so that the change of administration doesn't actually change the dynamic.
It's interesting, John Brennan being an appointee of President Obama, you'd think they would be for excavation of this, but when it comes to being CIA director and people bring things to you to defend your building, it puts you in a different type of position than you ordinarily would have been.
Well, and he was a lifer, and he was there, and his views on enhanced interrogation probably cost him the CIA directorship 5 years or 4 years earlier.
Right.
So he may have ended up in this report somehow, but my bet is, yes, he's just vigorously defending his guys.
That's right.
Which you'd sort of expect. And he is, once you get those instincts going in him, he's really quite aggressive about protecting his people. So
I can see that.
And I think Dianne Feinstein probably the same. So
right,
it's
right.
Just not a match made in heaven.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Here's the question. Of the DCIs that you saw, the Directors of Central Intelligence, who handled Congress the best?
Leon Panetta handled Congress. You're talking about when I was staff director of the committee. When I was at the White House, I thought General Hayden did a great job also. But certainly when I was staff director of the committee, Leon Panetta had a real touch and rapport with members of Congress because he'd been a member of Congress.
Right.
He knew how to talk to them. And it wasn't just that he knew how to talk to them. He was able to share more information. He felt comfortable and confident enough sharing really deliberative type options that the president was considering, and members of Congress appreciated it because they felt like they were part of the process and not frozen out of it. So,
and there weren't that many leaks out of it.
I think that's what people don't understand. People like to casually say the leaks come out of the legislative branch. That's not my experience. My experience is that it usually comes out of the executive branch. And, for example, they briefed Chairman Rogers in on the Osama bin Laden raid in January before the May raid. I mean, but I think that Leon Panetta definitely had a deft touch with the members of Congress, and they appreciated it.
Yeah. Well, it is true. I'm a creature of the executive branch, and I spent a lot of time with senators and congressmen, but I always felt like I was juggling nitroglycerin. I was never completely comfortable just sitting down and having a beer with them for fear that I'd say the wrong thing. And, next thing I'd know, I'd have half the appropriations I used to have. All right. Well, thank you very much. Blinking Red. It's a great book. One of the things that I think is a flaw in our system is we come in to these jobs new, the political appointees, and we inherit a bunch of facts, but we don't know the background of those facts.
It's just
he hates us, he loves us, he wants this, she wants that. And only when you read the stories that lead up to your position and the 5 years before you came into government do you understand why it is that she wants this and he hates us. For anybody who's in intelligence now, reading the story of how we got the DNI we got is an important part of understanding the system as it exists today.
Yeah,
so it's a great book.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. This has been episode 13 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. I want to thank Michael Vadas, Jason Weinstein, and especially Michael Allen. We hope you'll join us next week for the insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government. And in fact, we're hoping to have the lead for FBI cybersecurity joining us then. So tune in then. And for more information, please visit our website at www.steptocyberblog.com. Thanks.